radio for extreme times. This is A View from Space with the Spaceman on Talk Radio AM 640.
I'm the Spaceman. This is View from Space. I'd like to welcome you in if you're driving around town right now, listening to AM 640. I welcome you in. Or maybe you're at work listening right now, checking the show out via the AM 640 app, picking up the show that way. I welcome you in also. Or if you're listening to me right now on Shaw Direct on channel 865, I welcome you in too. Or maybe you're listening on the fastest growing way to check this show out, your 3 or 4G personal communication device loaded with the via the stream, the world software, picking up the show that way. I welcome you in. Or maybe you're what some still call the best seat in the house, sitting in front of your Mac, your PC, logged on at home to 640toronto.com, picking up the live audio streaming there. I welcome you in. Wherever you are in the world, I welcome you in. Well, for the 31st Olympiad over now, everything is starting to get back to normal because, you see, when Olympiads happen, all news of the world seems to stop. As in the ancient days of past, even wars were called off. And now we've put away the Labor Day holiday, too, marking away the end of summer. That's past. People now returning back to their regular routines after celebrating that last fling of the summer. The Illuminati-controlled mass media wasted no time. It's hit hard as they got right back into high gear on their fear-mongering agenda. It was pretty calm on those 3 weeks of the 31st Olympiad in Rio. Well, the first week back even flaunted the elite's favorite go-to guy for the nuclear scare. The guy they always go to play the biggest fear card there is, the nuclear threat. North Korea's eccentric, egomaniacal bad boy, Kim Jong-un. And this week supposedly causes a 5 magnitude on the Richter scale earthquake with yet another one of his tests of a nuclear bomb. And as usual, the United Nations world leaders again call a meeting to talk about it again. What a ritual they've got going on there, right? Well, there's something behind it. Something big behind it. North Korea said it hit the button on its 5th and potentially most powerful nuclear test earlier this week, claiming to have successfully detonated a powerful nuclear bomb, a warhead that could be mounted on ballistic rockets, which they supposedly don't have. State media in Korea announced that the test would enable North Korea now to produce a variety of smaller, lighter, and more diversified nuclear warheads of higher strike power. So a spokesman for the James Martin Center for Non-Proliferation Studies, that's code for an Illuminati group that puts out the fear-mongering, said it's hard for us to verify their claim, but the deep fear is that they'll launch a live nuclear weapon on one of their missiles, which would be extremely dangerous, and that could trigger a war. Yes, beware. We've got a maniacal, extremist, paranoid freak in North Korea, who has the bomb. And beware, yes, the sky above. Soon the sky above will be transformed into a weapons platform for this North Korean maniacal despot to deliver nuclear missiles aimed at the West. Be very afraid as this ritual continues on. There's more to it, deeper into the show tonight. As a matter of fact, all of this week has nudged us, reminded us to look up There were all those stories about outer space this week. Have you noticed? This, of course, typified by the number one star this week for intergalactic news, the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, that franchise hitting the airwaves 50 years ago this week. So, of course, the Illuminati-controlled mass media got behind that big time, because this week also had the news of the American astronaut Jeff Williams setting a new American record just this week, as announced, and has now become the most experienced American astronaut ever. Williams safely touched down back to Earth this week along with a pair of Russian cosmonauts. Coincidental, right? On the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. After living on board the International Space Station, the American astronaut has now spent a total of 534 continuous days in space. So he now holds the record for Americans for the most time living in space. The latest mission of the ISS was Williams' fourth trip, by the way. He's also done four spacewalks since his first mission into space in 2000. But the longest record ever of man ever being in space was set by Jeff with the Americans, but still he has a long way to go to beat the world record. All the countries participating. Russia, the cosmonaut Gennady Padalka, holds the world record. He spent an incredible 879 days in space. That's nearly 2.5 years. Without coming down. Then there was this. Yes, there was more space news on the back of your, back to your regular routine after the summer and your first week back. The Illuminati-controlled mass media also announced, coincidentally, just this week, that Philae had been found. Philae, you remember the little lost comet lander finally found? How? Well, the search of the surface of this comet at Zaun 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko was exhaustive, says the research team. They were listening intently for any sign of the lander signal to triangulate its location, and they tried but couldn't find the exact resting place of Philae. It remained a mystery. Ah! Until this week, the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. An image taken on the comet's surface back in September 2nd, just a few weeks ago, the Rosetta team finally locates the little lander Philae, wedged in between some rocks. That news released just this past week. How about that? They can pinpoint a tiny lost vehicle on an asteroid that took all of 10 years to reach and have finally found it through photos that were taken, but failed to spot an astronaut, or an asteroid rather, that we're told came within 40,000 clicks of smashing into Earth. Guess what? This week. Oh, and they can find Philae on this rock that takes years and years to reach, but they can't keep an eye on Kim Jong-un. I guess we're just going to have to catch up with some better spy technology, because our deep outer space technology is working just super fine, according to the Illuminati-controlled mass media. Is this not the biggest joke that they want us to swallow? No, there's more. Wait till I come back after the break. This is Talk Radio, AM 640. I'm the Spaceman. It's a view from space, and, well, I'm just getting started. I'm the guy to call Space. I communicate by email only. A couple of addresses, spaceman@640toronto.com or space@640toronto.com. And I really, sincerely appreciate the one you've sent. And I thank you so much for them. So as I've been saying, 50th anniversary of Star Trek, they just jumped at leftists jumped at that blaring headline as Kim Jong-un sets off a nuclear bomb this week. Also, Philae has been found on that comet. No, I did a show on that when they first landed on that. Philae is actually named after a small, tiny island in the Nile in Egypt. And there was only one building on that little island, and it was only used, that island was only used for one purpose and one purpose only. The temple of Isis existed on Philae. And people went there only. The very elite went there to worship Isis in that Philae temple. And also, the American astronaut, Jeff Williams, this week sets an American record for days spent in space. So a lot of outer space stories hit this week, along with the scare with Kim Jong-un. And not only that, also announced this week, the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, the spacecraft Juno, which has just recently been bombarded with radiation, we're told, as it neared Jupiter, has now settled into an orbit around Jupiter, giving us the clearest, closest pictures ever, all time, of Jupiter. When? On the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. Jupiter, of course, known as the King Planet. We're informed that Juno, the little lander, eventually needs to swoop in even closer to Jupiter to do its job. The mission actually is just getting started, like me. Kicks into high gear next month, October, when Juno fires its engine again to tighten its orbit closer to the surface of Jupiter. Then, every couple of weeks, the spacecraft will skim Jupiter's clouds to peek into its stormy atmosphere. And they say the real work is about to begin. Juno will fly closer to the King Planet than any other spacecraft ever all time has done, skipping over cloud tops, peering in deep inside to uncover clues about the giant planet's formation. So our new high priests of black magic wizardry slash scientists hope that understanding how Jupiter formed can help explain how Earth and the other planets evolved as well. Well, it starts with the king, doesn't it? It's another part of the ritual to bring about the one they call the one, who will lead the world forward into a coming one-world government. The New World Order, as I call it on this show. This space probe is called Juno, named after, of course, the ancient Roman goddess, the protector and special counselor of state. Juno was the daughter of Saturn and sister, but also the wife of the chief god Jupiter and his mother of Mars and Vulcan. Juno also looked after the women of Rome. Her Greek equivalent was Hera. And you know what happens to Juno, the spacecraft that's supposedly orbiting Jupiter right now as I speak with you? When her mission is complete, Juno's finished the job, she will intentionally plunge into Jupiter's atmosphere and burn up. Galileo, the first spacecraft to orbit Jupiter, met the same fate after a 14-year mission. Now, this fiery end to Juno is expected in 2018, a couple of years from now. Why the suicidal move? Well, the black magic wizards slash scientists say Juno is going to protect precious information that we don't have yet. Because, you see, NASA states that the suicidal destruction of Juno is going to prevent any chance of accidental crashing into Jupiter's moons, particularly Europa, considered by NASA, of course, as a prime target in the hunt for microbial life in the solar system. But imagine what man is supposedly capable of if you listen and believe to what these lies are that are coming out of the Illuminati-controlled mass media is telling you this week. Man can now send vehicles as far away as the planets that take years to get there, and when they do arrive, we supposedly have the ability to even manipulate them, to even zoom in, take pictures of certain areas, and then send those pictures back for us to have a look at. But we still don't have the technology to see if there's something coming that's on a collision course with Earth, just a few thousand kilometers away as it passes by. Put another way, the elites want you to believe, it's what they want you to swallow, that their new high priests, these scientists, know nothing about what surrounds your house and your front yard, but know and can do so much more when it comes to lands far away, but got no idea what's happening in your backyard. It just doesn't make sense. It doesn't pass the sniff test of logic, even. No, there's a concerted effort on this week, the special week of the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, a show that did so much to brainwash the world's masses into believing that man has the capability for interstellar travel. I mean, before 1948, when the first UFO was cited, coined, people started talking about it. Before 1948, you were absolutely out of your mind. You were crazy. You were a tin foil hat maniac, if you believed in aliens. Today, from 48 onwards, we start off with, well, stuff like My Favorite Martian. Oh, and there's so many of those television shows. Once we got television, look out. They could land men on the moon and do all kinds of things and convince you totally, because seeing is believing. And then all what followed with all of the Star Trek, the Star Wars, brainwashing the masses, showing that man is capable of interstellar travel. This false thought of man being able to travel through the sky to other planets is key. It's the cornerstone of a lie. But if man can do it, surely out there somewhere, because our little devices have shown us how full of places that there are, that there could be life out there, somewhere in the universes, aliens live that are more advanced than us, more capable than us, and surely, surely, sometime we're going to be contacted by them. And the lie goes on even further to postulate the idea that these aliens will turn out to be, in fact, a way more knowledgeable than mere man is, and that they were our creators. This changes the whole vision of what God is, correct? This sets up the alien invasion I speak about so very often here on ABFS on Talk Radio AM 640. Now, not only could Kim Jong-un devastate the planet with his soon-to-be-acquired nuclear missile to deliver the nuclear bombs that he already has with the power to actually create a 5 on the Richter scale earthquake. But there could even be a close encounter with not a friendly alien at all, a hostile alien entity that is this is so determined to stop man from blowing off any nuclear bomb that could Well, destroy a corner of the universe. Throw everything off. An exploding planet. A plot, by the way, that was the center in many Star Trek episodes over the years, propagating this brainwashing, this lie. And what Star Trek also did was showed you that there were many places out there where they would land and find aliens. All kinds of aliens. It was like going to the zoo, for God's sake. They were everywhere. All kinds of them. So surely, we've got their attention and they're watching. So that's what the Illuminati wants you to believe. It's all bogus. It's all a lie. No, the average person's belief system has to change. And just recently has begun to be shaken in every corner of every person's life. Even the view of what your sexuality changed. I mean, everything to fit the fear agenda of the Illuminati. And the reason it's being done is to bring about the new world order, the new global system with the new religion, Luciferianism. It's a cosmic religion. You don't have to go very far back to remember a time here on Earth where the skies were really friendly. Not today. There was even an airline, I think, that had a slogan, wasn't there? Yeah, it was United. Fly the friendly skies. Remember that? It was a marketing theme used by UA. Their earliest slogan was the Mainline Airway. And that was used to promote its signature New York-Chicago-Frisco route. And that slogan was replaced in 1965 with Fly the Friendly Skies, just after man landed on the moon. In fact, the Friendly Skies tagline was in use right up until 1996. Then the slogan adopted after the merger of United and Continental in 2010 is Let's Fly Together, but replaced, and guess what, in 2013 was brought back. Resurrected. A new life. Reborn. Fly the Friendly Skies slogan was back again. Still being used now. Space, talk radio, AM 640, more next. I got to call Space. It's a view from space on talk radio, AM 640. Emails to spaceman@640toronto.com or space@640toronto.com. Yes, this is the 50th, the big 50 anniversary of Star Trek being launched this past week. But also coming up on this Sunday, this week was also 9/11's 15th anniversary, September 11th, coming up tomorrow. As my emailer writes, Space just wanted to let you know a piece of steel, a beam from the South Tower, rolled through my neck of the woods here in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, heading for Newfoundland. Lots of firemen, police, and bikers wondering if they'll test this piece of steel. Signed, MG from Sydney, Cape Breton. Thanks for that. But 9/11's 15th anniversary was kind of usurped, taken off of the front page, and the Illuminati-controlled mass media was just chock full of the 50th anniversary of Star Trek because they have an agenda. 9/11 had an agenda, too, but hey, the war on terror is going quite well. Thank you very much. Everybody is pretty much changing all of their laws to accommodate that. Civil liberties are going the way of the dinosaur. Yes, I can remember a time when we didn't have to look up and be afraid. I can remember a time when the sky was portrayed as a friendly, wondrous sight. to behold. I remember as a kid laying on my back in the prairie, totally black, clear nights on the prairie, by the way, where you can hear, see the stars, behind the stars, behind the stars. It's so black, there's no lights. Out in the Bald Prairie in the middle of nowhere, Saskatchewan here in Canada. Me laying on the ground with my buddies, looking up and watching the almost countless shooting stars, as we call them, zooming across the sky. I mean, in Saskatchewan, you got a big sky, and you have to look down at the horizon. Down, yeah. It's huge. There's nothing standing in your way. As they say, you can see your dog running away for 4 days. Yeah, those shooting stars, as we call them, zooming across the sky. And shooting stars are simply comets, meteors, asteroids that are basically the same, just according to what size they are. And meteorites, shooting stars, are smaller than asteroids, which also can be a shooting star. And the tail of light phenomena that you'd see is the meteor entering the Earth's atmosphere and vaporizing. A fireball is created. Yeah, back in those days, the sky was never really ever a threat to our safety. Never. There was never any hint of a cataclysmic collision with something running into Earth. Nobody even thought about that. It was never mentioned. There was never any propaganda whatsoever disseminated in the media about getting Earth involved in a collision with some giant space rock hurtling through space at thousands of miles an hour, aimed right at us. But it's almost a monthly occurrence now. Why the pickup? It's the agenda of the fear agenda. The sky is a very dangerous place. Beware of the enemy, your sky. The sky was even portrayed as romantic, not long ago even, with visions of Disney's Tinkerbell sprinkling stardust all over the beautiful sky. You've seen that logo a million times. With just the wave of the magical wand in her hand, all those lovely little pixie dust, asteroid dust, charming the little children into believing whatever Disney wants to program them with. It was a time when, well, lovers even would park in late evenings under the canopy of a blanket of beautiful stars, with the moon bathing the earth in its soft moonlight. Yeah, back then the only real threat from the sky was maybe a possibility of a thunder shower that would occasionally pass by. It's a stark contrast to today. That's how the sky is portrayed by the Illuminati-controlled mass media. Because now, today, the sky is a major threat. Yes, I said a threat. It's even feared as much as a terrorist attack is today. It's used in the Illuminati-controlled mass media in the same way. The sky is no longer something that to be admired. It is something to be feared. It could possibly be a superstorm, torrential rain with winds over 100 miles an hour. It could be a terrorist attack coming from the sky. It could be Kim Jong-un's missile he never told anyone about. This new age we've entered into, this new age of chemtrailing, giving man the ability to manipulate weather patterns, global weather patterns, feigning climate change. And you couple that with the capability that man has today with laser technology to heat or say cool the eye of a hurricane from a nearby Earth orbit satellite, in order to enhance the power of that naturally created storm and steer it anywhere they want it to go. These storms are now some sort of freak Frankenstein creation, these superstorms with the chemtrailing. Case in point, the latest threat from above supposedly came from just this past Wednesday, as the headlines screamed, no, not a superstorm, something much more scary. The headlines were all over the front pages around the world. Whew. Large 32-foot asteroid passes just 40,000 kilometers from our planet today. That's how close again? NASA says that it was 10 times closer to the Earth than the Moon is. Just think, only a tenth of the distance between the Earth and the Moon was this 32-foot asteroid rock going at thousands of miles an hour, but just missing us because the asteroid's orbit supposedly carried it below or over the Earth's south pole. It didn't pass within the orbits of communications or weather satellites, we're told. So there was no problem there, but it was just as close as our communication satellite's orbit. Now, just to give you an idea of how incredibly fluky that miss was, this week, on the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, how completely dependent upon Lady Luck we are to have narrowly escaped a near devastating collision with a giant 32-foot space rock that had the potential to annihilate hundreds, even thousands of human beings, not to mention all the animals and the untold damage it would have done to a wide area. Now, we supposedly were, this past Wednesday, completely vulnerable to this possible fatal, devastating crash with this asteroid, and we had no idea it was there. And by the time we discovered it, it was too late. It was already about to pass by and undetected. Now, what are they asking you to believe here? It's absurd. You mean to say there's no existing technology that can detect an asteroid not more than 40,000 kilometers out? How vulnerable we are is the message here. How dependent we are on just blind luck to escape these incoming threats to our planet. And we can't detect these near misses. We can't possibly find out what Kim Jong-un's doing. But we can find Philae on an asteroid that takes 10 years to reach. It's the Spaceman Talk Radio, AM 640. There's more right after this break. This is ADFS. It's Talk Radio, AM 640. I'm the Spaceman. Emails to space at 640toronto.com or spaceman at 640toronto.com. Thanks for the one that you sent me. HW writes, hey, do you think that it could be possible that the elites would cause a catastrophe on planet Earth by exploding many nukes and, say, blaming it on a meteor or some alien spacecraft attacking the Earth? I remember, he says, when Ronald Reagan came out with his speech about all our differences on Earth would change if there was a common threat from outer space, bringing the world together against a common enemy, aliens. My emailer writes, think about it. Who would know if it was nukes, meteors, or aliens, for that matter? Well, we wouldn't know, but the Illuminati-controlled mass media would certainly tell us what it was. And we're brainwashed enough now to believe it, that it is aliens. Because I believe they're going to fake an alien invasion, and you're going to see some genetically modified... Can I call them people? Things. Entities, okay? That they have created and grown in a human woman's uterus and brought them to life, trained them to be the role of an alien in an upcoming episode coming to you. A screen near you, that virtual screen that they love to fill with their lies. Yes, we've been informed after the fact that an asteroid came within a distance of 40,000 kilometers this week. That's just 24,800 miles. That's according to NASA, who apparently knows very little. They say the closest space rock will come to Earth for at least the next half century was that one. Well, how do they know that if they couldn't track this one? How do they know the closest space rock has already passed us, that will pass by Earth for at least the next half century, next 50 years? Well, they've said they've missed this one, so who's to say they won't miss another one that's even bigger that shows up on our doorstep a few years from now? See, it's also ridiculous what they think you'll swallow. But many actually do believe it because of the brainwashing of our virtual capability of interstellar travel in our entertainment. And the phony news stories about NASA's projects in outer space. They're all believed. The missed asteroid, that passes this week, grazes, isn't the only threat coming from our sky, from the dark side of our sky. Yeah, the sky's now gone over to the dark side, too. The latest threat is, came out this week, too, on the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, a huge 200-foot asteroid. You think this one, this 23-footer that just missed us earlier this week, is something? Well, how about a 200-foot asteroid that somehow NASA does know about, that is approaching and is set to pass us by in exactly 1 week from tonight? Next Saturday night. It's due to happen September 17th, next Saturday. The Virtual Telescope Project, NASA says, discovered the asteroid a couple of days ago, this past Thursday, on the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, and says when it passes Earth, the asteroid will be visible from the southern hemisphere only. NASA also went on to say, too, that the Virtual Telescope captured photographs of the asteroid. That's a huge clue for you, by the way, on where NASA is getting its so-called knowledge from. To see through this hoax, you must now know the computing world's definition of the word virtual. That definition is not physically existing as such, but made by software to appear to do so. Get it? Virtual, not real. It's virtual. In the computing world, one more time, the definition of the word virtual is not physically existing as such, but made by software to appear to do so. Black magic. Because magic, after all, is just very simple. It's making someone think that it's happening when it's not. That's magical. It's not real. It's magic. Or
today's word?
Virtual. Remember, to get anything out of a computer, you must first put it into the computer. These mad scientists, these high priests of the cosmic religion of Luciferianism, are programming their far-fetched ideas on how they'd like to think the universe works and behaves. And it comes out of the computer as truth. When it's simply absurd. It's called electional science, where the so-called scientist no longer does tried and true methods of scientific experimentation at all. That takes so much time, and there are so many things to do, and all that information, that relevant data, has to be collected and then tried and tested again. No, it's much easier to simply say, I want it to be this way, so I'm going to damn well program the computer technology to corroborate my views. And that's what's happened. Then they turn around and tell you, technology allows us to do things we could never otherwise do. Well, you're right about that, including passing off the lie as truth. Here's the latest propaganda on this next encounter with the next giant asteroid coming from this dangerous sky we live under now, that we should expect the end of next week, next Saturday. 1 week exactly from tonight. According to a NASA database, another much larger asteroid is also set to sweep past us, one that could cause devastation if it hit our planet. This huge asteroid could be up to a mile long. But luckily, this giant rock is going to pass at a safe distance of 7.3 million miles away. The space rock is predicted to whistle past our planet at 31,000 miles an hour next Saturday. And this space rock is going to pass within 24,800 miles of Earth. So it's only going to be about 40,000 clicks out, just like this 23-footer was this week earlier. Yeah. NASA's really pulled all the stops out to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, haven't they? And I'm not done yet. The biggest one follows this week, the space story of the week. Next on Talk Radio AM 640. I'm the guy to call space. It's A View from Space on Talk Radio AM 640. And there's only one way, besides this microphone and you listening, that I communicate with you. It's spaceman@640toronto.com by email, or space@640toronto.com. We start rolling in before the show even begins, and I thank you so much for the one that you've sent. I really appreciate them. I really do. So NASA is really been front and center all of this week. And I've got the big one that's coming up that happened this week. But we've had the American astronaut, Jeff Williams, setting the record for consecutive days in space for an American. All of this on the 50th anniversary of the Star Trek television show hitting the airwaves. Also, Philae was located, that probe that landed on an asteroid. And Juno is now taking the closest, best pictures, the clearest pictures we've ever seen of the king planet, Jupiter, planted very deeply into people's minds for the brainwashing of the coming one, the king, the one they call the Antichrist. And we've just been almost clipped by, well, within 40,000 miles of a 23-foot space rock asteroid. And we have another one coming that's way bigger next Saturday. Could be up to a mile long. But it's only going to come within a distance of 7.3 million miles, so says NASA, who missed this other one. But the virtual reality telescope they have picked up this huge one coming near Earth next Saturday night, September 17th. It'll whistle past us at about 31,000 miles an hour, a backward 13. With a distance of 24,800 miles separating us from Earth. So, NASA is also not certain of the time it was due to pass next Saturday, relying on estimated calculations, they say. And it could be up to, well, 16 minutes out by their estimated flyby. Really? How come we can't be exact, gentlemen? But they do stipulate that this asteroid does have the force to wipe out all humanity. It's almost absurd what they get away with saying, and so bold. Now, that brings me to the last and biggest of all the space stories that hit this week in the Illuminati-controlled mass media. The 50th anniversary of the Star Trek television show. NASA's bold mission to bring pieces of an asteroid back to Earth took flight this week. Of course it would go this week. The spacecraft is called the OSIRIS-REx. Launched this past Thursday, blasted off from Florida just before sunset, Cape Canaveral, on a NASA mission to make a connection with yet another asteroid. It hopes to get samples from this asteroid, a small rocky body flying around the sun, and bring them back for our scientists / high priests of wizardry to study. The mission is supposedly going to be the first time NASA has ever sent a craft to make contact with an asteroid, and they say they've chosen one which is fairly close to Earth. It's been named Bennu, but it's still really far away. Now, remember that name, Bennu, because I've got more on that in just a few minutes here on AVFS, on Talk Radio AM 640. The mission, launched by NASA this past Thursday, will supposedly take 7 years, and it's not expected back with its special cargo until September of 2023. The agency's OSIRIS-REx spacecraft, as they call it, lifted off from Cape Canaveral Air Force on Thursday, 7.05 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. That's 23.05 Greenwich Mean Time. Riding a United Launch Alliance Atlas V rocket into an evening sky suffused with golden light, they said. Liftoff for this OSIRIS-REx, this spacecraft, and its seven-year mission beginning, is to boldly go to the asteroid Bennu and back, the NASA spokesman Mike Curry said during a live launch broadcast, with an apparent alluding to Star Trek, which celebrates its 50th anniversary this week. Everything goes according to plan. NASA expects this. OSIRIS-REx will rendezvous with a 1,640-foot-wide asteroid named Bennu in August of 2018, a couple of years from now. Snag some dirt and pebbles off the space rock a couple of years later and deliver this cosmic sample, this precious cargo, back to Earth, arriving in September, sometime in September, in the year 2023. Now, in August 2018, OSIRIS-REx meets up with Bennu, which is positioned about 140 million miles from Earth. The solar-powered spacecraft, they tell us, will then study Bennu, the asteroid, from orbit for nearly 2 years, using five different scientific instruments. This work will allow mission team members, they say, to choose the best possible spot from which to grab their precious samples. Yeah, not there. No, let's go over here a little bit. Maybe over here. Let's go to the other side. Let's just do a little tour. Then in July 2020, on the SCED for OSIRIS-REx, the spacecraft will then slowly descend toward Bennu's surface. But the minivan-sized spacecraft won't land at close range. OSIRIS-REx instead will deploy its touch-and-go sample acquisition mechanism. A disc-shaped sampling head at the end of an 11-foot-long robotic arm. This touch-and-go sample acquisition mechanism will contact Bennu for 3 seconds. It'll just touch for 3 seconds this arm. This robotic shovel. During this robotic space shovel, during this time, the probe will use nitrogen gas, they say, to blast the asteroid's surface, stirring up dust and pebbles that will then be trapped within the touch-and-go sample acquisition mechanism sampling head. The goal, of course, is to get at least 2 ounces of material from the surface of Bennu, the asteroid, and truck it back to Earth, arriving in September of 2023, like I said. OSIRIS-REx, this spacecraft, will then place this sample inside a small return capsule, similar to the one used by NASA's robotic Stardust mission, which delivered samples of the comet Wild 2 to Earth, we're told, in 2006. What a joke. The bits of Bennu, we're told, will land in Utah, as standards capsule did for the comet Wild 2, in September of 2023. Then OSIRIS-REx spacecraft, meanwhile, will be placed into a holding orbit pattern around the sun, allowing it to possibly perform an extended mission if NASA decides to grant and fund one. OSIRIS-REx is NASA's first asteroid sampling effort, but not the first such mission in history. It was JAXA, Hayabusa. That mission succeeded in bringing tiny grains of the asteroid Itokawa to Earth in 2010, if you've been watching and keeping close track on the program there at NASA. And JAXA's Hayabusa 2 probe, launched in December 2014, sampled another space rock named Ryugu. Now, NASA has returned material of other types of bodies, but Stardust sampled a comet, for example, and the Genesis probe brought home pieces of the solar wind that, in 2004, most famously, astronauts lugged more than 800 pounds of lunar rocks, if you'll recall, and dirt back home during the Apollo missions in the late 60s and early 70s, which were all proven to be fake, by the way. The moon rocks were fake. That's a known fact, but it's never, ever mentioned in the Illuminati-controlled mass media. No, they don't talk about it, but they're fake. So allow me to reveal the ritual that NASA is unveiling on this marking of the 50th anniversary of the television show Star Trek. That when I come back. It's Talk Radio AM 640. I'm the Spaceman. More next. This is ABFS. It's Talk Radio AM 640. I'm the Spaceman. I communicate by email, space@640toronto.com. One address, the other, spaceman@640toronto.com. Hard to keep up with them, but I'm trying, believe me. DS writes, hey, Space, love your show, man. In your opinion, is there going to be an election in the United States of America? Well, I'll answer that now. I'll say yeah. I have this uncanny gut feeling, my emailer writes, that martial law will be enacted before the election. Maybe not officially martial law, but emergency measures to keep the public safe. Your thoughts? DS from, I believe it's in Ontario, a small town in Ontario. Well, the propaganda is out there big time. It's ABC and their new series, Kiefer Sutherland stars. He plays a character called Tom Kirkman. And it's going to hit the airwaves very soon. It's called Designated Survivor. And what it is in the United States of America during the State of the Union, one cabinet member is always taken to an undisclosed location. This is because in the event of a catastrophic attack on, say, the government, the cabinet member can then become the country's new president. Such a person is named as the designated survivor, hence the name of the ABC television show series. In the show, Kiefer Sutherland, his character, Tom Kirkland, Kirkman, is a low cabinet member. Do you get it, Kirkman, by the way? Kirk is church. Okay. Man. So, Tom, the church man, is a lower cabinet member and is the designated survivor during the State of the Union. Shockingly, it happens. A bomb explosion kills all the cabinet members, leaving this man, Kirkman, to become the new president of the United States. The explosion that takes down Congress and the ABC thriller series is to be called the most devastating attack in the U.S. since September 11th. So to make matters worse, this Kirkman guy, who's never elected president, becomes the president, and has never even, as a matter of fact, been elected for any position at all. In fact, President Richmond had fired him the same morning. All cabinet members died in the explosion. That's how it starts out. And away we go with the propaganda. That's from ABC, by the way. So, no, I believe there will be an American election. It's just the hype surrounding the American election, which is going to be a quantum leap, by the way. And the fifth year, we're going to see. The fifth year being, see, a leap year is every 4 years. Well, on that fourth year, there is a huge quantum leap forward, a push of, a burst of energy that will push the world into a new train of thought, a new level, if you care to call it, in terror, coming in the fifth year, which is next year. So the American changeover, the presidency, of course, goes in with this quantum leap that I've been talking about on a few shows lately here on AVFS on Talk Radio AM 640. But back with tonight's show, where the OSIRIS-REx spacecraft lifted off this past Thursday, heading to an asteroid called Bennu. So allow me to reveal the ritual that NASA has unveiled. The name of the vehicle alone is a dead giveaway. OSIRIS-REx is the spacecraft's name. It's named after Osiris. Of course, Osiris is the first and supreme sun god in the ancient Egyptian religion. His son, Horus, from his immaculately conceived mother, Isis, is the reincarnation of Osiris, and every descendant that follows in this royal bloodline is a reincarnation of Osiris, the sun god, which is really the bloodline of the tribe of Cain, by the way. That is the bloodline from which the Antichrist will come. The other part of the vehicle's name spells Rex, R-E-X, meaning king. As in the king planet Jupiter, mentioned also this week. So the name of the vehicle is Osiris the King. Launched just before sunset, because the sun dies, you see, when it sets. But right at the end of the day, before it died, the sun god Osiris spacecraft lifts off in the sunshine. The news release from NASA described it again this way. The agency's OSIRIS-REx spacecraft lifts off from Cape Canaveral Air Force Station here on Thursday, riding a United Launch Alliance Atlas V rocket into an evening sky suffused with golden light. Next is the near-Earth asteroid that's getting a visit from a NASA spacecraft in 2018, has received a new name. That asteroid, which was formerly called 1019855 originally, 1999 RQ36, but now it's going to be known as Bennu. Interesting. Very interesting. A name, we're told, was proposed, submitted, by a 9-year-old boy in a contest to name the asteroid run by NASA. This 9-year-old boy named Michael Puzio, 9-year-old in grade 3, attends a school in North Carolina, in the United States. NASA announced the name change to asteroid 1019855, 1999 RQ36, changed it to Little Mike Puzio's idea. Bennu. Let's call it Bennu, the little 9-year-old said. Well, little Mikey Puzio was among 8,000 or so students under 18 years of age from 25 countries who submitted thousands of names to be given to this asteroid in a naming contest, obviously to recruit new believers, right, in everything NASA says and does, because the future, after all, is our children, right? And the kids will go, wow, some guy our age named that asteroid for NASA, and they used it. Well, that's the effect it has on young minds. It is integral for NASA, the Illuminati, for them to be on board, those youth, that youth, for this major coming hoax. It's a must that they're on board. So let's get a little kid to name a rock, is the thought process at NASA. Well, wouldn't you know it, the name Bennu has everything to do with not something a 9-year-old kid in grade 3 would come up with. It has everything to do with sun worship, Osiris, with the ancient Egyptian mystery religion, the New World Order, the coming Antichrist, who is of the royal bloodline of Osiris, Cain. The name Bennu could not possibly have been the sole idea of this 9-year-old from North Carolina. First of all, North Carolina, smack dab in the middle of the Bible Belt in America, where Jesus is God. In fact, North Carolina is being chastised and sanctioned by the elites, corporations, rock bands, because of their transgender bathroom ruling that they will not change to allow in that state. And next is the fact that this 9-year-old has no clue as to the mythology of Osiris at all, or any understanding of the ancient Egyptian sun worship religion. The word Bennu has a deep, inextricable connection to this ancient sun-worshipping religion. According to Egyptian mythology, the Bennu was a self-created being said to have played a role in the creation of the world. It was said to be the Ba of Ra and enabled the creative actions of Atum. It was also said to have flown over the waters of Nun that existed before creation, landing on a rock and issuing a call that determined the nature of creation. That Bennu, as it's called, as it was known, has also always been a symbol of rebirth, of reincarnation, and was therefore naturally associated with Osiris and the Egyptian sun god himself. Some of the titles of the Bennu bird were He Who Came Into Being by Himself, and also Lord of Jubilees. The Lord of Jubilees refers to the belief that the Bennu periodically renewed itself like the sun. Its name is related to the Egyptian verb wubn, meaning to rise in brilliance or to shine. The Bennu bird is also really the exact same bird as described in the ancient Egyptian religion as the phoenix bird in the ancient folklore. It's virtually the same bird, just with another name. And as you're already well aware, especially if you're a regular listener to AVFS on Talk Radio AM 640, NASA has had a long history of ritual missions named after sun gods. The one that landed on the moon, Apollo, Mercury, that took John Glenn up in his first single orbit, Atlas, Saturn, some of the really well-known mission names at NASA. No, the truth always lies within the mission's logos at NASA. Because when the space shuttle was constantly launching, I was going deep into each and every single one of those launches by those spacecraft. And every one of those missions had a logo with a symbolism inlaid in it. And I would, every time they had a liftoff, every time a shuttle took off, I did the play-by-play and the reading into it all. They used to call me, and they still do, NASA's worst nightmare. I'm a spaceman. It's Talk Radio, AM 640. Email to space at 640toronto.com or spaceman at 640toronto.com. Thank you so much for the one you sent. I thank you so much. I really appreciate them. So as I was saying before the break, you're really well aware, especially if you listen to this show for any length of time, that NASA has had a long history of naming their missions after sun gods. The ancient Egyptian mystery religion is all over everything they do. This OSIRIS-REx mission just screams it. You see, they say, oh, we didn't name it after a sun god in some Egyptian religion. No, OSIRIS is really O-S-I-R-I-S, and it's just an acronym for the O is the origins, the S is the spectral, the I, the first I, is the interpretation. The R stands for resource. The I, the second I, stands for identification. And, of course, the S stands for security. So, actually, the name of the vehicle stands for origins, spectral interpretation, resource identification security. How about that? The REX part is the Regolith Explorer. R for Regolith, E for EX for Explorer. So they didn't mean it was probably just a coincidence that Origins Spectral Interpretation Resource Identification Security just happens to spell OSIRIS. Well, okay. Now this logo image where the asteroid named Bennu appears at the top of the pyramid in the ancient Egyptian myth religion is very revealing in a way that exposes NASA's practice in the occult. This simply illustrates how selected this particular asteroid is as their target. As well as the name OSIRIS. Now, if you know about the Bennu bird, You know the phoenix or Bennu bird was venerated at Heliopolis, ancient Egypt, where it was said to be living on the Benben, or the holy willow. The Benben, you see, is the capstone of a pyramid or obelisk. Because right at the top of an obelisk is a little pyramid, four sides. You can see the Bennu inscribed on the face of the Benben that was on the pyramid of Amenemhat, the third, by the way, in Egypt. This just isn't some obscure ancient history to occultists. No, this is a secret religion practiced by our world leaders. When a symbolic presentation is presented with Bennu appearing as on the capstone of a pyramid, it's not just an illustration of how they selected an asteroid as a target. Now, compare the mission logo of the OSIRIS-REx to the Bennu graphic. The triangular logo features Bennu. It's a Benben stone. The asteroid is set like an eye within the triangle, so it resembles the capstone that hovers above the pyramid, just like is on the great seal of the U.S. $1 bill. There's a Benben there, coming down, circled in red. The pyramid is on the most common Federal Reserve note, the Benben stone, prominently displayed on the U.S. $1 bill, with a capstone not yet placed upon the top of the pyramid, meaning that all of the system of this New World Order has been built, but the Antichrist has not arrived to sit on the top of it yet. That's the Benben stone that I've just been talking about. The Bennu. The world's largest obelisk, seen from the window of the Oval Office in the White House. The world's largest obelisk can be seen from that, from the president's desk, just behind him in the Washington Mall. It's called the Washington Monument, that huge obelisk. It can be seen sitting in the Oval Office, represented by the President of the United States. Get the sexual connotation here? Out the front window is the penis. And where does the President sit? Why, inside the Oval Office. See, an obelisk is, in fact, in the Osiris myth, identified as the phallus of Osiris. The Benben that the Bennu is identified with is an image of the progenitor enabler, the penis of Osiris, because this allows him to keep the power. This penis does. His seed forms the next ruler in the bloodline. This mission logo also pictures the entire pyramid with the flat top of the probe's upper wing suggesting the bottom edge of the capstone. What's more, this mission logo for OSIRIS-REx is seen as an eye inside a triangle and is a model of another venerated part of the human body, the anal triangle, as it's known in the occult. The anus is called the Eye of Horus, by the way, by all occultists. The OSIRIS-REx mission logo shows their probe in action, probing. It looks like they're taking a stool sample. And you're telling me, a little boy in North Carolina came up with that name. That's loaded with that incredible occult knowledge. So, occult meaning hidden. The OSIRIS-REx's mission, spelled with R-E in capitals and the X in small caps, is a lot like capital R, small X, which is another symbol representing the Eye of Horus, by the way, in case you didn't know. It's all drugstores. use the R and the X, the small x, right? It's also something else. It's not only the Eye of Horus, it's the Eye of Ra. Ra is the name of the sun god in the ancient Egyptian mystery religion. It was the pharaohs, the ancient pharaohs, who first began pharmacology, pills, drugs, so that they could enlighten themselves and reach a higher level in their initiation chambers, which were the pyramids. And look how well this all fits in with the latest NASA ritual. So the strange spelling of Osiris Rex with caps and small caps, forming the R-E small caps X. In Latin, Rex means king. NASA is exalting King Osiris, and Bennu represents the most high god. I'm sure it was a nine-year-old boy, a little nine-year-old boy from North Carolina that knew all this deep, intricate occult knowledge about Osiris. Aren't you convinced? Oh, by the way, Lucifer's favorite disguise? A little boy? Being a little boy? Satan's favorite blood sacrifice? An innocent young male. Spaceman Talk Radio, AM 640. More after the break. On the Bennu.
This is Spaceman. This is ABFS on Talk Radio, AM 640. Emails to spaceman at 640toronto.com or space at 640toronto.com. So the Bennu is actually a bird that really is the phoenix bird. And the phoenix serves as a type for understanding by nature. It's renewal. It's steadfastness to endure the burning flames which actually consume it. And then it's reborn again anew. Not my words. Those are the words of Leonardo da Vinci, who is a Freemason, describing the Bennu. The legend of the phoenix bird, periodically reborn, the Bennu bird, periodically reborn from the ashes of its consumed body. It's a myth from the mystery language of the ancient wisdom, so old that no man, we're told, knows the time or place of its origin. Now, I believe that the Bennu, the phoenix bird, is really, in fact, code, simply to describe empires that rule the earth. And every few hundred years, the empires crash, burn up. But out of the smoke and ashes and the turmoil rises the new empire. And that's what the phoenix bird is symbolic of. I'm sure that's true. So the Bennu, this phoenix bird, is found in both the East and the West. It's everywhere. It sets forth in poetic imagery the law, universal throughout nature, that individuals, civilizations, races, and worlds are perpetually reborn from the ashes of their former selves. Various aspects of the myth have been brought up by different people, and by comparing these, the student's mental conception of the phoenix myth begins to take form and color. And it's seen to be not an image of fancy and superstition, but of a symbol of some kind of eternal truth, which means every single empire that rules eventually falls and another empire replaces it, but always with the same bloodline at the very top. They kill their old empire, just as I'm saying to you now, the industrial empire is going to crash, led by the American empire. This industrial age is going to close into a digital information age, which is now being birthed, as you can see with the technology. No more jobs. There's no need for jobs. The industrialized age is over. We could use less people in this new world order also. So many will perish on the way to this new empire that's about to emerge from the crash, the death, the burning of this American empire that rules this old industrial age that we're leaving, going into a digital informational age. According to the Greek historian Herodotus, the phoenix bird, the Bennu, came from Arabia at the close of every 500 years and flew to its shrine at Heliopolis in Egypt, where it deposited the dead body of its parent, really in actual fact its former self, which it had brought encased in an egg or ball of myrrh. Another and later version tells of the bird at the age of 500 years building a nest or funeral pyre of frankincense and cassia and other fragrant herbs, which it lights by vigorously fanning the pile with its wings until it catches fire. Then, when its body is entirely consumed, the phoenix rises from the flames and flies away a new bird. In the collection of popular legends of the Middle Ages, called the Physiologus, the phoenix is described, the Bennu is described as an Indian bird which lived upon air only, and after a period of 500 years, loaded himself with fragrant spices and flew north to Heliopolis in Egypt, where he enters the temple dedicated to the sun. And of course, what do you think helio means? It means the sun, the Heliopolis, city of Heliopolis, dedicated to the sun. And he deposits his load upon the altar, which is burned to ashes. The renewed bird emerges at once, and in 3 days is full grown and flies away. The phoenix was known as the Bennu bird to the Egyptians, closely associated with the daily rising of the sun. The Bennu, in fact, was also referred to as the soul of Ra and symbol of Osiris. So, in the Book of the Dead, we find these words spoken by the dead person. I am Bennu, soul of Ra, and guide of the gods in the Tuat, meaning the underworld. Let it be so done unto me that I may enter in like a hawk, and that I may come forth like Bennu, the morning star. And of course, Lucifer is described also in the King James Version of the Bible as the morning star. So, from many passages, you learn that the Bennu, which is the soul of Ra, which appeared each morning under the form of the rising sun, was supposed to shine upon the world from the top of the famous pear seed tree at Heliopolis in Egypt, wherein he renews himself. That from A.E. Wallace Budge's book, The Gods of the Egyptians. He also, in that book, talked about the pear seed tree, appearing to have been a member of the laurel family, and is used as a symbol of the world tree, which is representative of the hierarchical system in which we live, in whose higher parts the reincarnating monad finds its rest. According to Egyptian belief, the phoenix or Bennu bird self-generates. rises like a fragrant flame above the Persea tree, the world tree. Or again at night as the soul of Osiris it rests in the tree above the sarcophagus of Osiris. And in other places, you'll find that Nile God, referred to as awakening to life in the soul as the Phoenix Osiris in the plants. There's also other references to the morning stars I've pointed out as the one who ferries Osiris or the Phoenix from the east. In Persia, the world tree was the oxhorn tree, which contained the seeds of all plants, possessed the power of renewing the universe at the proper time. On it perched the sacred eagle Smirk. When he flew upward, the tree was so agitated that 1,000 twigs shot out. And when he landed again on the tree, again he broke off thousands of twigs, which scattered seeds on all sides. There's an obvious comparison there with the cosmic outbreathing and inbreathing, the expansion and contraction which all things undergo. It's the Spaceman on Talk Radio AM 640. More next with the little 9-year-old kid's idea of calling this asteroid Osiris Rex is flying to Bennu. And I'm just rolling through some of the info on Bennu for you out of the mind of this little 9-year-old boy from North Carolina's mind, I'm expecting. Spaceman Talk Radio AM 640. I've got to call space. It's View from Space, Talk Radio, AM 640. Emails, too, please, at space@640toronto.com or spaceman@640toronto.com. Appreciate the one you sent. Really do. Thanks so much for it. So, there was a 9-year-old boy in North Carolina who entered a contest sponsored by NASA, who asked that this new asteroid that they have chosen to target to scoop some rocks and dust off and ship back to Earth, not coming back, by the way, until September of 2023, a 7-year mission. Okay, 7, keep that in mind here, because I'm just about to launch into the meaning of that, why it is a 7-year mission with this ritual of NASA. They're not going there at all. It is a show for you. So they blame, they give credit to the name Bennu, submitted by this little 9-year-old boy in North Carolina, a grade 3 student. Names the asteroid that's targeted Bennu. Spells exactly the same way as in the Bennu in the ancient Egyptian mystery religion. B-E-N-N-U. So I'm just giving you a little background of what the Bennu is. The Bennu, you see, is the very tip, the very top part of a pyramid. And in the American $1 bill, the capstone, the Bennu, has not yet been placed upon this decapitated partial pyramid, as you can see. And there's an eye in the middle of it around surrounding this triangle capstone. That's the Bennu. The eye is the eye of Horus. So you see the ritual that is being performed here in a supposed space flight into the heavens. Okay? So, among the Turks, the Bennu, the Phoenix, same thing, was known by the name of Kirkis, and according to tradition, was said to live 1,000 years, at the end of which time it consumed itself by fire, rose anew to live another 1,000 years. This is repeated 7 times 7, or 49 times, when the day of judgment came. Madame Blavatsky, the founder of the Theosophical religion, once again, for you, if you haven't checked into it, is a way to become a god. And that way is to find out the sacred knowledge. You must know the sacred knowledge and go up the level steps. As in Freemasonry, you start at the bottom, you work to the top. In a corporation, start at the bottom, work to the top. So theosophy is basically man becoming God through knowledge. All right. So Blavatsky, who founded that religion, states in one of her books called The Secret Doctrine 2, by the way, the 7 times 7 = 49, which is, by the way, a, yes, hidden 13, is a transparent allegory and an allusion to the 49 manas, the 7 rounds, the 7 times 7 human cycles in each round on each globe. The Kirkis of the Turks and the Onek of the Hebrews stand for a race cycle and the mystical tree Ababel, the father tree in the Kurilan, shoots out new branches and vegetation at every resurrection of the Kirkis or of the Phoenix bird, the Benben bird, the Day of Judgment, meaning a minor Pralaya. That's from Madame Blavatsky, the founder of the Theosophical religion. So you see, this 7 times 7 human cycles in each round evolves through a graduated series of 7 races. Groups of people, each race, whatever degree, is separated from its successor by a cataclysm of greater or maybe smaller magnitude. In other words, I'm talking about an entire race of people wiped out. And these situations take place at about the midpoint of each and every one of these 7 times 7 races, 49 times, to the Day of Judgment. And at the time when the peak has been reached and the downward plunge has commenced. So, another writer, G. DePruwrecker, points out that while the Babylonian Nero's leaders of 600 years comes as close to any of the Phoenix cycle as commonly understood in Europe, nevertheless, the symbol represents the cyclic nature of all recurring periods of time, both great and small, rather than any particular cycle. Cycles of many different lengths have been associated with the Phoenix bird, but it's interesting to know that this one writer, G. DePruwrecker, gives the life cycle of what he calls a tribal generation, or the active, expansive period of what we know as a nation, as about 500 years. So I told you, the phoenix or the Bennu, this bird, this magical, mystical bird of the ancient Egyptian Mysore religion, is merely just a code word for empire. And that's what empires, nations do. At which time the nation, having reached its crest of importance, begins to decline, America, while a new nation rises to take its place in the world, this global entity that's coming. The information digital age leaders. Races like the individuals composing them all have their youth, have their maturity, and then, of course, old age. Modern Europe supposedly rose from the wreck of the Roman Empire and will, when its time has come, give place to its successor, the rising and falling of empires. It would seem that in many places in the world today, the phoenix bird, the Bennu, is fanning his wings above the fragrant higher of national consciousness in order that a rejuvenated humanity, a renewed world with hopes and ideals that may again take a step forward and upward enlightenment. That's what the elites, the Illuminati, have in store for us, or the people that survive this cataclysmic event that's being planned cut the world's population. At present, the world is undergoing a series of slow alterations in climate change, in structure, borders, in religion, which are all as important as the events which have disrupted human societies in the past. These geological changes, these social changes, these political changes will continue and increase since man and his home, the Earth, cooperate and evolve together through the ages. One subrace after another gradually separates from its parent stock and enters upon its golden age. And then will find the physical conditions it needs for its development. And then it will die, replaced by the new. In America, today, the blending of racial strains has resulted in many new characteristics. In the United States, the majority of people have already combined several European strains of people, races of people, and will gradually become a race apart. In Canada, the English, Scottish, French, Italian, Indian, and other stocks have combined in the same way. South of the Rio Grande, a couple of thirds of the population is colored with Indian blood in the mestizo, emerging and forming a new race or races. Foreshadowings of great races to come is what the Illuminati believe. Mixing all of the world's races together as one is the plan for the New World Order. Throughout these lands, ancient America is renaissance qualities, hopes, before unknown, as fanned by the wings of the Bennu. The world is waiting for the rebirth of this new empire, this digital informational age. In America, a living symbol, the Quetzal, is said by many to be the most beautiful bird in the world. It lives high in the cloud forests of Guatemala, we're told, in South America, and Honduras, and commands admiration whenever it's seen. In American mythology, the Quetzal was the solar bird, the dweller of the great spaces, and symbolic of the supreme spirit, just as the Bennu is the spirit of Ra. The colors of its plumage can be seen in the green, the red of the ancient wall paintings, and the trailing tail is repeated in the long and colorful ceremonial robes that you see if you go to Guatemala, Honduras, South America. Quetzal nests only in the loftiest of trees, and the nest has a couple of openings, one for entrance and one for egress. The long plumes not permitting the bird either to turn about or to back up. Closely connected with Quetzal was the serpent Coatl, symbolic of the earth. Not the inert matter, but the living fire of the globe, often represented as the two-headed dragon. Put them together, Quetzalcoatl. More next on Talk Radio, AM 640. I'm the Spaceman. I'm Space. It's View from Space. It's Talk Radio, AM 640. Please direct your emails to spaceman@640toronto.com or space@640toronto.com. Thanks so much for the one you sent. So, as I was saying before the break, Quetzal nests in only the loftiest trees. In the Americas, Quetzal is said by many to be the most beautiful bird in the world. Lives in the high cloud forests of Guatemala and Honduras. Quetzal is the solar bird. Coatl is the symbol of the earth, the god of the sun-worshipping empire in South America was Quetzalcoatl. When a man enters the fire, ascends, and is united with the solar or Buddhic splendor, the man becomes illuminated, all-knowing, a god. His inner vision is opened up to infinity. He's closed with the solar radiance and was then known as the plumed serpent, Quetzalcoatl. As his brothers in India called him the great Nagas, or serpents, and in China, or whales, they were called dragons of wisdom. They're enlightened, powerful elite. The radiance of the spirit was always symbolized in America by quetzal plumes in the headdress. From this custom came about that all chieftains gradually came to use feathers and of other birds as a sign of honor and achievement. That's where the feathered hat came in. Everywhere the phoenix myth signifies, above all else, the principle of self-regeneration as a necessary part of the life cycle of both individual and the race of people. So it's therefore a doctrine of hope, a doctrine of promise, of unending evolution. In India, Kartikeya was born from fire and water and nursing of the Pleiades, combining the attributes of both Mars and Apollo. Kartikeya was said to exist for the purpose of destroying Taraka, a demon who had seized occult knowledge and powers belonging to the gods alone. He is represented as having six heads, one for each century of the 600-year cycle of his rule, and is shown riding on the peacock, the Hindu phoenix, the Hindu Bennu. The eyes of the peacock feathers were said to represent the starry heavens, while about the body of the bird were concealed the signs of the zodiac. So the allusion to the destruction of the demon Taraka as a punishment for possessing occult powers applies to the self-destruction brought upon a race by the misuse of atomic energy or a similar force. Possibly the greater part of the world stands in abject fear of today, nuclear technology. That's what Kim Jong-un's job is to impose this occult power of self-destruction that could demolish, just be the end of a whole race of people by the misuse of atomic energy or a similar force, like an asteroid hitting the Earth. As he was called in Kartikeya, in India, called Kartikeya, to kill the Taraka demon. Kartikeya and his phoenix peacock steed represented the critical midpoint of any racial cycle. The phoenix in Japan is represented by the Howo, as they call it. That's a mythical bird composed of a peacock, pheasant, and a bird of paradise. But it's all the same story. The Howo in Japan dwells in the high regions of the air and only descends to earth when bearing one of the immortals or upon the birth of a great sage or emperor. In other words, a new empire is formed when one bearing one of the immortals descends to the earth from outer space, or the birth of a great empire, leader, emperor, a great sage, one who knows all of the dark sentences of the occult. In China, the Feng Huang, or vermilion bird, dwells in the southern quarter of the heavens, rules over the midpoint of the day as well as over the midpoint of any cycle for a race. Astrologically, it's the brilliant red star Antares in Scorpio, and with its companions Regulus in Leo, Aldebaran in Taurus, and Formalhaut in Aquarius, rules over the four cardinal points. These stars, known as the four royal stars by the ancient Persians and the four Maharajas by the Hindus, are referenced in The Secret Doctrine by Madame Blavatsky, the founder of Theosophy, who says, that which Mr. G. Massey calls the four genii of the four cardinal points, and the Chinese, the black warrior, the white tiger, vermilion bird, and azure dragon, is called in the secret books the four hidden dragons of wisdom and the celestial nagas. The Fenghuang in China, believed to have had its origin in the sun, and to drink only waters from the Kunlun Mountains, feeding upon the tender sprouts of the bamboo. As in Japan, it's associated with the coming to earth of great souls, and with the beginning of wise and beneficent rains. It's a symbol of the yang, the spiritual principle. Its plumage contains the five colors. It's called a sweet blending of the five notes. Its low notes are like a bell. Its high notes are like a drum. When it flies, 360 kinds of birds follow, and the legends told of it, countless. So there's a thread of esotericism running through all of those legends I just talked to you about, linking the thought of the East and the West, vitalizing the myth, until the truth it really embodies shines like a many-faceted jewel, a constant reminder that there is no death, but only endless change and evolution as mankind progresses from humanhood to Godhead. It's the symbol of the immortal self, which after playing one part on the stage of life, discards his old dark garments and passes on to another act in the great drama. Can you say reincarnation? That's where they're headed. That's what they believe. And to become God, a God, you must reincarnate, what, how many? Seven times. That's where your seventh heaven comes from. Because once you reach the seventh incarnation, you have become enlightened and are a God and have gone through all of the levels. So as each empire is destroyed, a race, an entire race destroyed, collapses, a new rises to take its place. So what if I told you the Illuminati want to make you believe that this is a fact? And as their actions, where there's nothing new, it's simply history repeating itself, will be repeated again. That, say, for instance, this race that you and I live in today as we're peaking, maturing as an industrial nation, will, in fact, be destroyed. A new generation will arise with a new world order. The elites want to make you believe that that is going to happen, and that it possibly could be facilitated by an asteroid colliding with Earth, which is a concept that's not new. In fact, the Illuminati wants you to believe that it's happened many, many, many times before, and that it will again happen soon. For instance, the dinosaurs wiped out from an asteroid hitting Earth. Now, what if I told you the evidence for the collision of these asteroids impacting the Earth and affecting all civilization and destroying an entire empire or race of people is actually found in the ancient Babylonian, ancient Greek, and ancient Roman myths? Well, let me reveal you. Let me tell you what the Illuminati intend to point to as their smoking gun evidence that what I've just said is true. That asteroid colliding with Earth will change everything. These cosmic cataclysms, these collisions of celestial bodies, has and will happen again. So be warned, it's going to be proven as truth by our elites on this world. It's the Spaceman on Talk Radio, AM 640. More right after this break. It's a view from space. That's all it is. I'm the Spaceman. It's Talk Radio, AM 640. Emails to spaceman@640toronto.com or space@640toronto.com. Thanks for the one you sent. I appreciate it. Now, like I said before, what if I told you the Illuminati wants you to believe that asteroids colliding with Earth is nothing new? In fact, it's happened before in history, and it's going to happen again. The collision of asteroids impacting the Earth, affecting all civilization, actually even reforming the Earth itself, are supposedly found in the ancient Babylonian, the ancient Greek, and the ancient Roman myths, those stories. So, I want to point out a few, reveal them to you, on what the Illuminati intend to point to as their smoking gun evidence that these cosmic cataclysms, these collisions of asteroids and Earth has happened in the past many times and will happen again in the near future. So, again, be warned. For instance, when you talk about cataclysms, the word Atlantis immediately comes up. In Plato's Timaeus, the myth of Phaethon is followed by the story of Atlantis, the island continent that sank into the sea following a cataclysmic of earthquakes and floods. The story, according to Plato, was true. But in what sense? In search of an answer to this ever-perplexing mystery of Atlantis, and curious to learn more about the foundations of Western philosophy, I went into the ancient Greek myths deep. A book called The Atlantis Secret, which not only contains a complete decoding of the Atlantis story, but also a complete decoding of all Greek myths, mysteries, and mysticism. And what's the link between Atlantis and the Greek myths? The answer, in a nutshell, is that they all convey a true story about cataclysms. True stories of actual cataclysms. Asteroids hitting the Earth and destroying all. Here's a few examples. Hesiod's Theogony, the creation of the universe, stemmed from an original fall of the sky. When Uranus, the mountain of heaven, descended and impregnated Gaia, Mother Earth. In Hesiod's words, great Uranus came bringing on night, and desirous of love, he spread himself over Gaia, the Earth, stretched out in every direction. As a result of this impregnation, terrible monsters were born inside the womb of Gaia, causing her to groan as a result of this tight-pressed force that was inside her. One of these titans, gods, was Cronus, who castrated Uranus and ascended to heavenly Mount Olympus to become its new ruler, kid-killing god. killing the old man. Hesiod then goes on to describe Cronos impregnating Gaia in the name of Rhea, after which there occurred a cataclysmic struggle between the titans of Cronos and an alliance of gods led by Zeus. The Hundred Handlers, as they're called, then engaged the titans in a great battle. With sheer cliffs in their stalwart hands, the boundless sea roared terribly round about. And the earth crashed loudly, and the broad heaven quaked and groaned. Tall Olympus, shaken to its foundations by the onrush of the immortals, the heavy tremors from their feet reached misty Tartarus, as did the shrill din of the indescribable onset and powerful bombardment. So it was when the two sides discharged their powerful missiles at each other. This is battle raged on, finally poised, until Zeus himself enters the fray. He plunges down from Olympus, where he had been acting as a cupbearer to Cronos, and threw his whole might against the Titans. So with continuous lightning flashes, Zeus went, and the bolts flew thick and fast. With a thunder and lightning from its stalwart hand, trailing holy flames all around, the life-bearing earth rumbled as it burned. The whole land was seething, streams of Oceanus, the undraining sea. The hot blast enveloped the Chthonic Titans, the indescribable flames reaching the divine heavens. It was just as if earth and the broad heaven above were coming together. What's being described in this myth is, of course, a cataclysmic event of an asteroid hitting the earth. So as a result of this battle, or this asteroid hitting the earth, Cronus and his Titans deposed from Olympus and consigned to Tartarus, the innermost depths of the earth. Included among these Titans were the four brothers Atlas, Prometheus, Epimetheus, and Menoetius, who provide more examples of cataclysmic thought in Greek religion. Atlantis, for example, confined at the ends of the earth where Zeus forced him to support the heavens, either with his hand, head, shoulders, or in the form of Mount Atlas by supporting the pillars that hold earth and heaven together in opposition. Atlas's role was to maintain the world order of Zeus by preventing the heavens from collapsing again onto the earth. Clearly, the idea of a cataclysmic space rock crashing into earth, fundamental to the Greek view of the cosmos. The myths of Prometheus, for instance, provide a few more clues. According to Hesiod, Zeus chained Prometheus to a pillar and sentenced him to an eternity of torture by an eagle. But this age-old tale, elaborated upon later by the dramatist Aeschylus, who describes how Zeus had chained Prometheus to the Caucasus Mountain, plunged it into the underworld amidst earthquakes, thunderbolts, and violent storms, which shook the foundations of heaven and earth. Again, a cataclysmic event from outer space. Prometheus, then, would remain in the underworld for an eternity, or at least until the end of the age when another cataclysm might elevate him from the murky depths. The concept of world ages was of tremendous importance to the Greek myths. The first world age began when Uranus impregnates Gaia and then returns to heaven, taking up residence in Mount Olympus. The second world age, after the cataclysmic hit, had been instigated when Cronos castrates Uranus, replaces him upon the Mount Olympus throne. And the third world age begins when Zeus deposes Cronos, was made everlasting after he vanquished Typhius and the giants. So, you see, each of these world ages begin with and is ended by a cataclysm. And it was hinted that the present world age, too, might be ended by the same type of cataclysm, which would herald another new age in the cycle of human history. So you see, I believe, with all of this asteroid talk of near misses and such, and visiting asteroids, and having everything to do with asteroids, of these incredibly large objects speeding by us, always keeping us on the high alert, that is in the Illuminati-controlled mass media for this sole purpose, and this purpose only. A cataclysm is coming, all right, but it isn't going to be an asteroid. Like my emailer earlier in the show wrote, what if a bunch of nukes were shot off in the world? They could blame it on aliens, an alien attack. They could blame it on a meteorite hit. Either way, they're covered. And the truth would forever be hidden, because no one would really know what it was that caused such a firestorm to end an empire. And the one I'm talking about is the one that rules today, the American Empire. Spaceman, back with more on the other side of the break on Talk Radio AM 640. I got to call Space. It's a view from Space on Talk Radio AM 640. Emails to spaceman640toronto.com or space@640toronto.com. It just never, ever fails to amaze me, the emails that I get. I'm referring to this one tonight. I want to call him AL from Costa Rica, who has sent me a fairly long email, which won't be passed on to you through the evening, but I want AL to know. I've been where you are. And in a lot of situations, I'm still in that place where you are at the time, and I feel a kinship after reading this quite long email. And I think it describes a lot of people who are feeling the very same way since they started picking up this show and listening to this show. So AL from Costa Rica, I thank you so much, and hello from Canada. I appreciate what you've written, and I know what it took to put it all together and write it all down. And I understand absolutely, completely, what's been going on with you. So back to, what if I told you the Illuminati want you to believe that an asteroid is going to collide with Earth soon? And this is being telegraphed all this week in the 50th anniversary of the Star Trek television series being launched, completely overshadowing the 15th anniversary of 9/11 even. That's how important it is to the elites. So I believe that the Greek myths, the Roman myths, and the Babylonian, ancient Babylonian myths actually are code for laying the seeds down to these cataclysmic events that end empires, like Atlantis. Obviously the most famous one of them all. Now, comets and cataclysms. cataclysms. In parallel with these world ages were the ages of man, according to Hesiod, the present race of man, the iron race, has been preceded by three earlier races, the golden race, the silver race, and the bronze race. Each of these, you can call them races or ages, each of these three peoples were destroyed by a cataclysmic event at the command of the gods, the most recent of which was the flood of Deucalion, the disappearance of Atlantis. Rather intriguingly, was dated by Plato to the third cataclysm before this flood of Deucalion. The Deucalion myth, if you haven't really researched it at all, don't know much about it, is probably the best known of all the Greek cataclysm myths, owing to its resemblance to the Noah's Ark story. And curiously, in Greek mythology, the hero Deucalion and his wife Pyrrha renew the race of man, not by sexual means, but by throwing stones. The idea was, in the book When the Gods Came Down, was the meteorites had been the seed of mankind. A further example of a cataclysmic thought in the Greek myths. So knowing this, it's no coincidence that Hesiod, linked with the battle of Zeus and the Titans to the founding of a meteorite cult. Cronos, he said, had swallowed the meteorite, but he had been forced by Zeus to eject it, whereupon Zeus fixed it in the earth at Delphi to become a monument, a thing to wonder at for mortal men. This famous meteorite, of course, is known to the Greeks as the great navel stone of the earth. Well, it's there, it's real, it's true. You can visit it today. In recent decades, a few of the eminent Hellenists, people like Walter Burkitt, Martin West, have built up a mountain of evidence that links the Greek myths to much older myths of the Near East, Mesopotamia in particular. Ancient Babylon. It's their opinion that the Greek myths belong to an earlier time and to an earlier place. So, might the Greeks' myths of the Greeks reflect cataclysms from an earlier time period? Books like The Phoenix Solution or And When the Gods Came Down state that the myths of Egypt and Mesopotamia are actually pervaded by cataclysmic ideas. For example, in the Babylonian Enuma Elish myth, in which Marduk defeats the sky goddess Tiamat, or the Akkadian myths in which Ninurta defeats the evil god Zu, or in the deluge myths, in the Epic of Gilgamesh in ancient Babylon, and the Atrahasis epic, or the myths of the sky falling and the gods descending from heaven, these being widespread in ancient Mesopotamia, Anatolia, and Egypt, while the oldest versions of these myths will actually date around 2300 to 2000 BC. It's surely the case, then, that they heard from the very earliest periods of Egyptian and Sumerian civilization. What inspired those ideas? The answer almost certainly is man's experiences with comets. Meteorites. In a series of recent studies, the scientists slash high priests, Victor Klub, Bill Napier, have argued that Encke's comet and the Taurid meteor stream are the remnants of a huge comet, Proto-Encke, that broke apart in our solar system around 80,000 years ago. In their 1990 book, The Cosmic Winter, Klug and Napier actually plot a series of dates at which the Earth's orbit would have been intersected by the orbit of the comet's debris, producing a high risk, very high risk, of cataclysmic collisions. So you see how the Illuminati have already started to plant the seeds. You can lift it from the myths. It's all about interpretation. Your perception. Significantly, one of these dates, 3900 to 3600 BC, marked the formative phase of the ancient Sumerian and ancient Egyptian civilizations. Klug and Napier, the writer's description of what ancient man would have witnessed in the skies. He wrote, "The slow evolution of the cometary orbits ensures that, at a few brief epochs in the past, the orbital tracks of the major comet and Earth intersected. Close encounters with a major active fragment over those centuries must have been spectacular and terrifying, with the comet nucleus, brighter than Venus, crossing the sky in a few hours, accompanied by a complex long red tail cutting the sky in half." More on the meteor storms in ancient mythology? Next on Talk Radio AM 640.
I'm the guy to call space. It's a view from space. This is Talk Radio AM 640. What if I told you the Illuminati want to make you believe that asteroids colliding with Earth is nothing new? In fact, it's happened so many times before in history, it's even recorded in the ancient myths of Babylon, the ancient myths of Roman, the Roman Empire, and the Greek Empire. And it's coming again. Well, the big sale is on, you can sure tell, at least this week, which just happens to be the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, that really can be looked to as the one television show that convinced more people about the possibility of man being able to do interstellar travel. And that aliens are likely out there. By the way, emails to space@640toronto.com or spaceman@640toronto.com. Let me call him LD. Writes me, "Listening to you via TuneIn Radio, trucking through Chicago. Just wanted to mention the latest episode of Big Picture Science by SETI is called Asteroids. A description of the episode is attached. It goes this way. Everyone knows that a big rock did in the dinosaurs, but smaller asteroids are millions of times more common and can also make a violent impact. Yet, unlike the bigger asteroids, we're not tracking them. Find out what we'd need to keep an eye on the size of space rocks, such as the one that exploded over Chelyabinsk, Russia, and how an asteroid whizzed by Earth just days ago, only hours after it had been spotted. Asteroids are the one natural disaster we can defend against. But an economist explains why humans are reluctant to invest in protection against low-probability, high-impact threats. This, on the latest episode of Big Picture Science by SETI. It's called Asteroids. Oh, guess, one of the guests on the show, by the way, Harvard Center for Astrophysics, Christina Ritchie. You know who she is? She's the NASA Planetary Science Deputy Program Scientist for the OSIRIS-REx mission I've been talking about tonight. So they're right there out there promoting right on the cutting edge. Just exactly what I'm talking about tonight. To convince the world that asteroids colliding with the Earth is nothing new. And it's happened before in the myths. I'm going through some of the
evidence, the smoking gun evidence, as I call it, the Illuminati will be pointing to. Because this is not actually going to be an asteroid hitting us, but it's going to be passed off as that. Who knows what lies in our near future. I do know one thing. Next Saturday, September 17th, an asteroid about a mile long is coming within 7.3 million miles of Earth. Now, meteor storms of ferocious intensity recurring annually when the Earth crosses the debris of a comet must have taken place during one of those ancient epochs. The shooting stars blazing out from a small region of the sky in Taurus or Aries. And on some occasions, the sky must have been filled with brilliant fireballs like storms, firestorms lasting for several hours. And some of these fireballs would actually on occasion reach the upper atmosphere or even the ground on Earth where there would be explosions. There could be no doubting the association of these spectacular phenomena with the supreme being in the sky. So, include in Napier's theory in their book, where they describe Encke's comet in the Taurid meteor system are the remnants of a huge comet that was called Proto-Encke that broke apart in our solar system around 80,000 years ago. Their book is called The Cosmic Winter, where I'm getting some of this information from tonight. Klug and Napier plotted a series of dates at which the Earth's orbit would have been intersected by the orbit of that comet's debris, producing this high-risk cataclysmic collision. Now, in Klug and Napier's theory, there's a catalyst and a timescale that provides a very plausible explanation for the cataclysmic ideas in ancient religion and myths. And yet, if we're to make any sense of it at all, there remains one vital puzzle piece that still needs to be put in place. Well, it's all very well proposing that the historical comets were the trigger for these cataclysmic myths, but the fact of the matter is that the ancient myths rarely describe cataclysms in an historical context. The fundamental theme shared by the myth makers of Greece, Egypt, Mesopotamia, Babylon, was that the cataclysms occurred at the beginning of time, when the seeds of life were first sown on the earth. It follows by definition, then, that these cataclysms could not have been witnessed by any man, and so should not be described as historical cataclysms. They may best be described as mythical cataclysms. Are you ready? Ancient virtual reality. Imaginary events, which even so, were held to be true as a matter of unquestioning faith. Like a lot of people believe the modern concept of how the Earth was formed with the Big Bang. It's just unquestioning faith. There's no evidence. Unquestioning faith. And remember, I described to you earlier in the show about the virtual telescope that actually found this asteroid that's going to be coming within 7 million miles of us next Saturday night. And that is fundamentally important, but it seems to elude everybody because the virtual telescope that supposedly sees this big one coming more than a mile long that could wipe out the entire population of Earth. That's how impactful this is supposed to be. Virtual telescope. The word virtual in computing means that it's not exactly the way it's hyped up to be, but it's actually a fake version of what they want it to be. That's what virtual telescope is all about, that's used by NASA. It's not exactly showing you what you're seeing. It's making it up by the computer software. In other words, it's fabricating a truth and spitting it out. So what appears to have happened is that ancient man witnessed cataclysms, all right, such as those maybe triggered by Comet Proto-Encke, like the authors I was talking about, Napier and his partner. But listen, imaginary events, which even so held to be true as a matter of unquestioning faith. So when you get your fill of Star Trek and Star Wars and aliens, you could have unquestioning faith easily about the concept of what Star Trek and Star Wars have programmed into your head. So the outcome of these deliberations, revealed in the books, The Phoenix Solution, when the gods came down, was the exploded planet hypothesis, the idea that a living planet exploded and sowed the seeds of life on the Earth. But this hypothesis then became a dogma in the hands of the Egyptians and the Sumerians, whose religions may best be described as exploded planet cults, just like we have in religious cults today. It's a Spaceman Talk Radio, AM 640. More right after this break. Yeah, it's a Spaceman Talk Radio, AM 640. Emailing two locations to get in touch with me, spaceman@640toronto.com or space@640toronto.com. So it looks like the mythical cataclysms were actually imaginary events. And people who can read into it in the myths of ancient Babylon, Egypt, the Greeks, the Romans, in their myths, it's just a matter of unquestioning faith. And so I was pointing out before this last break, it's exactly the same way as they're doing today with the virtual telescope project, which discovered this asteroid that is supposedly coming next Saturday, 17th. 200-foot asteroid, about a mile long. It's a sliver just screaming towards us. And their virtual telescope picked it up. And virtual, the computing word's definition of virtual, is not physically existing at all, but made up by software to appear that it does exist. It's a hoax. Now, because the exploded planet myth was by nature invisible, ancient peoples worshipped it by means of visible symbols, like the sun, the moon, and the stars. So they sowed the seeds for later confusion, because confusion is a very good friend of the Illuminati's. You know why confusion is a good friend? Because no one knows what the truth actually is once you become confused. So you wait for someone whom you respect with an authoritative position or manner about them to get them to straighten it out. Just like, oh, there was lots of rumors in the murder last night, but wait a minute, cops are going to talk about it now. Here's the top cop. He comes on, and he gives you the version that you believe, because he's the authority figure. So that's how cool confusion is for the elites. They love to confuse things, get people never knowing what to believe anymore. So naturally, when push comes to shove, they believe the authoritative figure. Do you think for a moment that any of these politicians, that we all know they lie to you, but for some reason, they're not lying when they stand up at that podium with all those flags behind them, making them look so important, so honest? And they won't appear without the backdrop, because it doesn't give them the prestigious look and symbolism. So the message doesn't work as well. And those tricks work over and over, and nobody even thinks about them as they watch the Illuminati-controlled mass media. Nobody even thinks about that, but they'll show the podium with the flags all around it, waiting for the authoritative figure to walk in and tell it like it is. Their version of the truth. So, because this exploded planet was by nature invisible, ancient peoples worshipped it by means of visible symbols, and sowed seeds for later confusion. But the mythmakers made sure that the true story of the exploded planet would never be forgotten. It shows through. For example, in the belief of heaven as an earth-like planet, particularly evident in the Egyptian tombs, and in the description of heaven and earth as twins, and in the use of identical metaphors to refer to both heaven and earth. The same type of clues feature front and center in the Greek myths, too. Theogony, Hesiod, referred to Uranus, the mountain of heaven, as one equal to Gaia, the earth, implying that Uranus, too, was a planet, and that the Iliad, Homer, had Zeus boast of how he could reconstitute an earth-like planet in heaven. It goes this way, or, come on, try it, gods. Hang a golden rope down from heaven, and all you gods and goddesses, take hold of it. But you could not pull Zeus down from heaven to the ground. But whenever I had a mind to pull in earnest, I could haul you up, earth and sea and everything. Then I could hitch the rope on the peak of Olympus so that everything once more should hang in midair. He's talking about the universe, the planets. Whether Homer knew it or not, he had described the exploded planet theory to a T, as would several famous philosophers in the 6th to the 4th centuries B.C. do it, like Anaximander, for example, describing how all things had begun with the tearing apart of a mysterious mass called the Unlimited, a nuclear reaction inside the Unlimited had caused it to produce a sphere of flame which surrounded it and then exploded into rings of fire. These rings of fire had then fallen to earth and become buried in the underworld, where they gave birth to the fiery lights of the heavens, meaning the sun, the moon, and the stars. Empedocles, in a similar way, described in the ancient myths, how all things began with a god sphere, which had been torn apart by the forces of strife. Strife waxed mightily in the members of the sphere, he said. They all trembled in turn. As a result of this discord, the elements of earth, air, fire, and water have been born, culminating in all material things on Earth. Anaxagoras, meanwhile, suggested that the beginning of time, the universe tilted toward the south in order that some parts might become uninhabitable and others habitable. So, his famous line, all things were together. After a visit to Egypt, he returns to Greece to declare that meteorites had seeded the beginning of all life on Earth. And then there was Plato, the author of the Atlantis story. In his famous theory of forms, he saw all things on Earth as being corrupt copies of perfect originals, which existed in the heavenly world of forms. This world of the perfect archetypes was an invisible metaphysical construct which lay between the visible heavens. And Plato described it explicitly as an earth-like planet, which he called the true heaven, the true light, and the true earth. Scholars, by their own admission, have been baffled by those ideas, but you got to say that theories of forms fits the exploded planet cult thought process to a T. A lot of Plato's ideas were Pythagorean in origin, and is no coincidence that a Pythagorean theory of cosmogony dominated Plato's Timaeus, his work, in which the story of Atlantis is told. So here the world of forms is personified by the Demiurgos, the god who creates the visible universe as a sphere in his own spherical image. The story is a cosmological riddle intended for initiates only, who had the eyes to see and the ears to hear. But what, you might ask, is it doing in the middle of the story about Atlantis? The answer revealed in the book, The Atlantis Secret, is that Atlantis was no lost continent or lost civilization, but something far more important. A metaphor for the lost planet that stood at the heart of the ancient religions. How did this metaphor work? The answer is not immediately obvious. But it's enough to say that Plato had no historian or geographer in his background. He was a mystic. Therefore, when he declared that the story of Atlantis was true, he had a mystic truth in mind, like the virtual telescope. It had a virtual world that it shows you. So to Plato, the true Atlantis lay in heaven, in the invisible world of gods and the gods. The mystery of the origins of the red dragon symbol, too, now the flag of Wales, by the way, has really confused a lot of historians, writers, and romanticists. And the archaeological community generally has refrained even from commenting on this most unusual dragon emblem, claiming it doesn't concern them. In the ancient Welsh language, it's known as Draig Goch, red dragon. And in Y Jinidur Kermig Prifskol Kimru, the University of Wales Welsh Dictionary. There are translations for the various uses of the Welsh word drag. Among them are common uses of the word, which is today taken to mean dragon. But in times past, it was also used to refer to the word meltdistal, meaning sheet lightning, and also meltdidarano, lightning accompanied by thunder. Yes. The ancient myths, still hanging around, still being taught in universities all over the world, for a good reason. It's a Spaceman Talk Radio, AM 640. More next.
I'm the guy to call space. It's a view from space on Talk Radio AM 640. Emails to spaceman@640toronto.com or space@640toronto.com. Thanks for the one you sent. So, really, in the mid-6th century A.D., the ancient Kimmeric Empire of the native Britons. Now, Kimmeric is basically another name for Wales, as in the Prince of Wales. And at one time, it had stretched all the way from Cornwall to the south of Strathclyde in the north, and was rapidly shrinking. And it was at that time that the bard, who called himself Taliesin, first read his riddle poem, Haines Taliesin, in the history of the Taliesin. To King Gwynedd, who, like the bard, had been a student of St. Lytton in the ancient Druid College, sun worshippers, later called Llantilfar in Morgannwg, was King Gwynedd the only one in his 6th century Conwy Estafod who was meant to understand the riddle poem? Or was it a gathering of initiates from all over the island? So comparatively recent origins of the Welsh national flag, that red dragon, the association of the dragon of the country of Wales dates much farther back. It goes all the way back to the start of the European Dark Age, actually, the times of King Arthur and the enigmatic Merlin, the magician, neither of whom have ever been proven to be definitively either mythical or historical. The exact nature and sequence of events in the middle 6th century AD that gave rise to the period we refer to as the European Dark Age is still up for grabs. Historians, archaeologists, they're not really sure. But over the past 20 years or so, certain paleoclimatologists have been comparing notes with archaeologists and astronomers. And interestingly, in the absence of written records, a lot of them begin to look a little more closely at mythology as a way to corroborate their findings of their researchers or their hunches. While a lot of this recent bout of interdisciplinary brainstorming is focused on the 6th century AD's start of the European Dark Age, earlier dates are also pretty interesting times to those embroiled in this paradigm shift of ideas, where the myths actually tell of asteroids colliding with Earth. So it's nothing new that we've been going through this threat and this near miss this past week. And it isn't it interesting, just after the time that everybody settles back in from a holiday of the summer. Right back into the saddle, back to the old routine again, and you're hit with asteroids. And one coming next week. A bigger one. This one they've spotted. So, in the order of things on the age of the Earth, each year a tree will put on another ring, right? Or the better the weather preferred by the tree, the wider the ring for that year. So one of the most striking features of this most accurate of dating methods used is still its ability to detect past climactic turndowns, evident in the narrow tree rings that bunch together over several consecutive years, indicating poor annual growth and an environmental downturn. Beginning in the year 536 AD and continuing through until 545, the dendrochronology record reveals a dramatic narrowest rings event in the trees. That's corroborated by some of the findings of the Greenland ice sheet projects. There, a pretty good absence of any telltale
tail volcanic acid spike in the ice cores, records suggest an altogether different cause. And that cause is dust loading in the stratosphere by minute particles of dust and other cometary debris. In other words, the sun's not shining. There's too much dust in the stratosphere for the sun's rays to reach through, giving these rings in these trees the look. And there was no telltale volcanic acid spike in the ice cores records. So climatologists and astronomers come together and concur that this event has all the hallmarks of, you guessed it, a cosmic winter scenario. You know what that is. When dust in the stratosphere blots out the sun, lowering the global temperature, hindering plant growth, and in so doing, undermining agricultural societies. This has supposedly happened a lot of times as a result of volcanic eruptions in some cases, but it can also result from dust loading of the stratosphere caused where the Earth's orbital path encounters the trails of cometary debris that literally boils off the ice and rubble comets as they approach the sun on their journeys through our solar system. And recently, in 2004, a small asteroid which disintegrated in the stratosphere above Antarctica supposedly deposited sufficient micron-sized dust particles to cause actual local cooling and much speculation as to the possible effects on the ozone layer. So a lot of the makeup of comets is submicron dust along with frozen water, methane, other gases, as well as other various organic molecules, pebbles, stones, boulders of metal, rocks measuring from a few feet wide to boulders many miles in diameter. The dust in small quantities burns up harmlessly as it enters the Earth's atmosphere, giving rise to what we call shooting stars, with larger grains often providing the most spectacular multiple fireball displays in the sky. Now, much denser cometary debris trails can overload the upper atmosphere with dust veils, with both locally and globally, causing cosmic winters similar to those caused by volcanic activity and nuclear war scenarios. So the larger rocks and boulders can bombard the Earth, causing impact craters, the elites tell us, that throw their ejected debris up into the atmosphere with much the same effect. While air-bursting meteorites can cause huge fireballs and intense blast waves that can devastate thousands upon thousands of square miles around the area of detonation, as happened in Tunguska, region of Siberia, in 1908. And in recent years, certain astronomers have increasingly come to appreciate that encoded in the folklore and the mythologies of a lot of cultures are the accurate observations of ancient sky watchers. Almost all tell of times when death and mass destruction came from the skies, events that are often portrayed as celestial battles between what they variously depicted as the gods. And curiously, the imagery of these myths have many common features, even between the mythologies of cultures widely spaced in time and location. Coming up next, a little translation of Geoffrey of Monmouth's Vita Merlini, The Life of Merlin, the mentor of King Arthur, mixed in with this cosmology, next on Talk Radio AM 640. On the Space Madness Talk Radio, AM 640, final segment in tonight's show. So, In Basil Clark's 1973 translation of Geoffrey of Monmouth's Vita Merlini, meaning the life of Merlin, Merlin the magician, as in King Arthur, he comments on the Laocoon tales and the particular story of the encounter with St. Kettigern. It's believed that Laocoon, by the way, and Merlin were really the same character. Laocoon is in the Scottish tradition, and Merlin is in the Welsh tradition, having rushed out of the woods. A naked and hairy madman, Laocoon, Merlin, is asked by St. Kettigern what has driven him to wander alone in this lonely place and keep company with the beasts of the woods. And he replied to St. Kettigern that he felt great guilt because he believed that he had been the cause of many deaths resulting from the battle of Arthuret, saying, "In that fight, the sky began to split above me. I heard a tremendous din, a noise, a voice from the sky saying to me, 'Laocoon, Laocoon, because you are alone and you're responsible for the blood of all these dead men, you alone will bear the punishment of the misdeeds for all. You will be given over to the angels of Satan, and until the day of your death, you will have communion with the creatures of the wood.' But when I direct my gaze towards the voice, I saw a brightness too great for human senses to endure. I saw, too, numberless martial battalions in the heaven, like flashing lightning, holding in their hands fiery lances and glittering spears, which they shook most fiercely at me." In Welsh, Merlin is called Meriden, and the Welsh town of Carmarthen is also, in Welsh, Carfridden, meaning the fortress of Merlin. Some 50 miles or so northeast of Carmarthen is an oddly named place called Llwyn Wormwood. Odd because in Welsh there is a word for wormwood, wormod, and because this is one of the least anglicized areas of rural Wales. And another place called Llwyn Wormwood is situated just 10 miles to the southeast, not far from the Welsh market town of Llandovery. Is it possible these places have information on the Merlin vision referred to in the Basil Clark translation of Geoffrey Monmouth's Vita Merlini? And what's most important, was the character known as Merlin a witness to a mid-6th century event of a cataclysmic meteorite hitting Earth? Since the spectacular events of July 16, 1994, when the newly discovered comet Shoemaker-Levy 9, which had split more than 20 into more than 20 pieces as it passes by Jupiter in 1993, had returned to bombard Jupiter's surface over the following few days, astronomers actually speculated nervously at the probable fate of our own civilization had those impacts happened with planet Earth instead of Jupiter. So it's happened to one of our neighbors. It could happen here. The number of known impact craters on Earth is growing all the time as satellite imaging technology advances, the virtual telescope, and growing list of impact sites dated from current interglacial periods in which we live leaves even the most ardent of catastrophist skeptics, that would be me, in no doubt that it has happened many times before, and it will certainly happen again. I don't believe it for a moment that there's anything out there that could come crashing in on us. I believe it's going to be man-made, and possibly we'll blame it on these collisions and the cosmos. Over the past decade or more, astronomers have taken ever more seriously the very real threat of Earth crossing asteroids and from cometary debris trails. In January of 2000, the British government actually commissioned a report into the threat from near-Earth object NEOs, as they're called. That report was published in August of 2000, and it set up the Commission of Inquiry as a result of continuous lobbying by a growing group of people concerned with this very fact, like astronomers, climatologists, archaeologists, and geologists. I mean, they're getting all of their well-trained, educated people, brainwashed people, to corroborate this fictional episode of actual comets running into the Earth. And a few of them even immediately stated, looking for the recollections of ancient bombardment events in the mythologies and oral traditions of the world's many past cultures. These researchers have brought to the surface a lot of tales, like that of the vision of Merlin described, in many geographically widespread cultures in the world. So what they're doing is they're actually going out and propagandizing the world that it is in fact true, and they're in the ancient myths even. It's been happening that long. Likewise, the Sumerian cuneiform tablets have been shown to have accurately recorded those most terrifying or temporary celestial events. Well, classical writings like the Epic of Gilgamesh and a whole bunch of other passages from the Old Testament Bible continue to be decoded in similar astronomical fashion. In the book of Revelations, for example, there's a mention of a star named Wormwood, which makes the waters bitter, creating a wasteland similar to the wastelands of Arthurian legend. Like I was just talking about with Merlin, many now believe that this is a reference to a future encounter with an asteroid, whose past catastrophic encounters and periodic return may have well been known to John of Patmos, the author, of course, of the Book of Revelation. The ancient Chinese even depicted comets as fiery dragons flying across the sky. Increasingly, anthropologists, archaeologists, and now even astronomers are speculating that the plumed serpent of the Aztecs and the Mayans in that sun-worshipping culture, and the many tales of winged serpents in the traditions of numerous other ancient peoples, also refers to, now changing their minds, to comets, to large asteroids that in the past had disintegrated in the upper atmosphere, producing enormous fireballs, reminiscent of the spectacularly terrifying and destructive multiple bombardments of past epochs. As the smoke trails left by these fireballs begin to break up, distorted by air currents in the atmosphere, they take on the eerie appearance of a snake, a veritable serpent in the sky, the cosmic serpent. Yeah. Enter Victor Klug, Bill Napier, those novelists again, for the frontispiece plate in their groundbreaking book, The Cosmic Serpent, about the past and present threat to our planet from bombardments of comet debris. Yes, we're being set up. Are you falling for it? But I know, whether it be blamed on an asteroid, or Kim Jong-un, or anybody else in a nuclear explosion, something is going to happen, and soon. We're being programmed for it. This is Spaceman. This has been A View from Space on Talk Radio AM 640. Coast to Coast next. I'm Spacin'. I'm out.